football on Off the Ball.
It was ferocious, incredible. The intensity from the stands just transmitted itself onto the pitch, and the city couldn't breathe.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join. Settle in.
On Off the Ball.
It's brought to you by Guinness 0.0.
All right, you are very welcome along to another episode of Settle In. Settle In is brought to you by Guinness 0.0. And this week, I'm delighted to say that we're joined by a woman who's got 58 caps for Ireland, having appeared in a World Cup. She's also played netball for Ireland and most recently has just finished up as the first female head coach at Leinster Rugby, Tania Rosser. You're very welcome. How are you?
Good, thank you.
How has life been treating you ever since the head coach job has been put into the rear view mirror?
Yeah, I mean, it's been challenging. Because I've been quite busy. The last 3 years have been quite hectic and it's just been rugby, rugby, rugby. So you kind of feel a little bit lost when you have this extra time. So I think I'm settling into it. I've got a little bit more time for myself. I'm not watching as many rugby games every weekend now. So, yeah, it's just moving on and trying to find something new, I suppose.
What did the rugby watching entail when you were in that gig?
Yeah, so we'd play the AIR Women's Games will be on the Saturday. Obviously, I'll be coaching Old Belvedere team. But then on Sundays, Mondays and Tuesdays, I'd review the footage of the other Leinster teams just so that I was always keeping an eye on the talent coming through and having a look at that. And then I'd also be looking at the under-18 girls and where they were sitting and how they were progressing through. So it's just lots of reviewing back over the other teams because sometimes, although when Balvo played Railway Union, you could see the girls on the pitch then, it just meant that I was keeping up to speed with how everyone was going throughout the seasons.
Do you have to watch other rugby then as well to keep up with trends, get ideas as a coach, as well as the talent identification piece?
Yeah, our house is rugby mad. Simon is the Leinster Academy manager, so our TV is basically on rugby all the time. I like to watch a lot of the Southern Hemisphere games, so Super Rugby and things like that, and look at the Farah Palmer and see what they're doing down there in the Premiership teams in the UK, because obviously our girls here in Ireland are going to be enticed to go there and play. So it's just to keep up to speed with what's happening over there and which players are coming through from that perspective as well. So a lot of rugby is on, if it's not on the computer screen, it's on the TV screen in
right.
the house.
And has that diminished at all since you've left Leinster, or still very much on all the time?
Pretty much, more so the men's game at the moment, because I've kind of taken a step back and I'm actually trying to enjoy watching rugby rather than analysing everything.
Can you do that?
No. I actually find it easier to watch my son play hockey.
Right.
Because I don't analyse it. And the sad thing for me is he's given up hockey this year. And he was a reasonably good player in school. But I got more enjoyment out of watching him play hockey than playing rugby or touch rugby.
Wow, okay. Mm. I think that'll probably strike home what a lot of people who work in sport or who have thrown their whole life into one specific sport. But for you, it has been two sports, right? I mean, does netball give you the same level of, I don't know, this is my job that rugby does, or is that a little bit more enjoyable?
Oh, I love netball and I love watching it so fast. People that don't understand it just think I'm crazy, but it's physical. Netball's quite physical as well. It's entertaining, but I can sit there and enjoy it. I can play when I'm playing. I still get competitive, but it's more level of enjoyment with the netball side of things. Thankfully, I haven't been asked to coach any netball here, because I probably would, if someone said to me, would you come and coach? Now that I'm not coaching Leinster, I probably would throw my hat in and do it.
Forgive the ignorance. How big is the netball scene in Ireland?
It's growing. They've got an international team now, and they've got, so they sit in tier two. So you have England, New Zealand, Australia, and then they'll sit in the next tier below. And they do reasonably well. Then they have under 17s and under 20 national teams as well.
There's a couple of different things I want to chat to you about. The coaching aspect is something that I want to come back to, but I do want to go back to the first barrier maybe that you overcame coming to Ireland, which was pure geography. When mm-hmm. you come to Ireland shortly after the turn of the century, how many years ago now is it?
24
years ago at this point. So 25. It is at the turn of the century, even just beforehand. Do you feel like an outsider when you come here? Do you feel immediately the embrace of people here, or what was that experience like?
So when we first arrived over, we were in Ballymena in Northern Ireland for a season. Simon played up there and I found the club really welcoming, more so the older generation of the club. They really looked after us. And then it was strange because we'd go to the rugby club and there'd be no females around. So I was kind of lost in meeting friends up there. But then Simon, we went home and Simon decided he wanted to come back. So we made a decision to move to the town to Dublin. At first it was a struggle, but the culture is very similar. So it's all about family, get-togethers and things like that. So we were lucky that when we came down here to De La Salle, there were a lot of Kiwis.
Right.
Which in some sense is really, really nice. But in other sense, you've travelled across the other side of the world and you're stuck with Kiwis. And I'm like going, ah. And Simon and I made a real effort not to go to the Kiwi pub. There used to be the Outback.
Okay.
Aussie and Kiwi pub. And we really made an effort not to go to those types of pubs to try and just to get the Irish sense of things. I was packing my first year, I'm not going to lie. I was packing my bag probably twice a month to go home. The weather used to get to me. And my family, I'm really close with my family back home. But Ireland's home now. I don't know whether we'll move back to New Zealand unless we get a good offer. I don't know.
Well, hopefully at some stage there's a great offer coming your way, either here or somewhere with regards to continuing your coaching career. Packing the bags fairly regularly at that point. What was the thing that motivated you to not hop on the plane, not hop back to New Zealand?
I think getting to see Europe and the Irish people there's a couple of Irish wives that were a little bit older than me that took me under their wings and they looked after me and they showed me around Ireland and we got to travel around Ireland. Back then, if De La Salle played down the south, we got to travel down the Friday night before. And it's just all those little things that they started to include us in. And I just think once I got over that, I can go home one day. And, you know, there was always an opportunity to go home. I just settled in and I just found my way. I found sport. I found that if I just immersed myself in something, that it took my mind off wanting to go home. So our culture would be quite huge back home, and I missed that too. And at the moment, I'm missing our Māori culture side of things. But, finding a group of people and sticking with them and, fighting through it, I suppose.
It's the great thing about sport is that it does create a brand new family for you, even if your genuine family is back home on the other side of the planet. It is interesting, though, the way you talk about having to overcome that first obstacle of being in a rugby club and it's a very male-dominated environment. Can you talk a little bit more about that and when you eventually did start to feel more comfortable in that place?
Yeah, I mean, I remember there was a South African coach in Ballymena and Friday nights everyone would go down the club and I rocked up with Simon and he asked me what was I doing there and I went, excuse me? And he's like, well, it's a male-only night.
Right.
I said, oh, wow. So I said, the only way you're going to get Simon to stay is if I'm staying. And he kind of just looked at me, and I think it was the first time he's a very strong South African coach, and I think it was the first time he was challenged on that. And then from that moment on, he just got over it and said, "Oh, if we want Simon to stay and play, Tanya's going to be there in the clubhouse all the time." When we got down to, I found down in the Republic when we came down to Dublin, they were more opening to us. There was a group of wives that we decided in De La Salle, for the mad reason to start up a women's team, and they thought we were crazy. But the De La Salle were so good. They used to welcome us and take us in for the club lunches, and it was brilliant. We used to sit there now. God, if you knew what we got up to back then. Flip. Let's just say
you're in a safe space here, don't worry.
Let's just say we didn't get out to the game sober back then when I wasn't playing international rugby, but it was fun. It was like sitting at the table, getting to know the older generation of the club and hearing all their stories about how they played rugby and the small connections that they had, a lot of them had with New Zealand, which kind of made me feel a little bit more at home and, you know, and how they looked after each and one of us differently was really, really, I don't know, enjoyable. And then one year we brought in a Romanian player to De La Salle, Mihai Riovanu, who's a winger. So he came and lived with us. So it was our turn to look after him in the environment. So it kind of, it was the circle evolved that new player will come in from overseas, get looked after, then we'd adopt the next player and it just revolved out like that in De La Salle, which was really, really nice. So it was a really lovely club to be involved with. And then I obviously moved on to other clubs since then, but I think De La Salle was really, really looked after us in the first two or three years we were here.
And did you find that Ireland was a few steps behind New Zealand when it came to being an inclusive place regardless of gender?
Yeah, definitely. I just remember any sports club back home. So our sports clubs are basically, you'd have netball and rugby together. You'd have kids, you'd have mums, you'd have grandmothers, you know, and usually the wives or the mothers are in the back getting the food prep ready for when the team comes home, comes back to the club. But I can never remember going to our home local club and not kids not being there or women not being there.
Yeah.
Like, we were always there. So when I came here, I found it really strange in the rugby environment that there weren't as many females around the place. Like, for instance, in my rugby club back home, Dad would have been one of the presidents and Mum would have helped in the kitchen cooking food. And then maybe I might have worked on the bar to help Dad out. But you'd have kids, you know, the first team would be fathers and their kids are running around in the changing rooms. Or if you're playing netball, you'd always go back and watch the boys play rugby, then you're back at the club together. So I think from that point of view, I found that really different and strange here when I first arrived, because I can't ever remember a sad day of not being in the rugby club with Mum, Dad and my brothers.
Mm. How do people react to you then saying this is actually not the way it should be?
I don't know. I think I first stumbled across it when I had Serge. So I had Serge when I was still playing international rugby, playing for Ireland, and breastfeeding him in a rugby club and got questioned about it.
Wow.
And that really was like, well, he's my child. I'm a mother. I'm going to feed him right here. Now, it wasn't like I had a blanket covering him and everything. And I think that was the first time I was really challenged on that inclusiveness of a rugby club. But I suppose it's a little bit different. When we were in De La Salle, there was a lot of Kiwis. So a lot of Kiwi players there. So the females were just naturally brought into it. And then gradually the more Irish women came along and, you know, I got really, like a couple of my best friends from De La Salle started coming along and supporting their boyfriends. And it just grew from there, I suppose.
What age is Serge?
Serge is 17 now.
Right, okay. So you don't have to go back all that far for that moment that you describe.
Yeah.
Were there people there to support you in that moment? Because it might seem like a very benign thing to the outsider, but it's obviously a hugely significant moment for you.
Yeah, I had, like at the time, I remember when I fell pregnant, because it was the same coach. I fell pregnant and he kept me involved as an assistant manager and help. And then when they asked me to come back, I think Serge was like 3 months old when I went back and played my first international friendly. And this situation happened in a certain club. And in fairness to John at the time, the coach, he said, what do you want to do? And I was like, I don't know what to do. I'm like a young mum. What am I supposed to do? He's like, look, we can either stay in the club and you're going to have to remove yourself maybe to the car to feed him or that, or we pack up and leave. I will support whatever you decide you want to do. In fairness, he backed it. He goes, I'm going to take the decision out of your hands. We're going to remove ourselves from that club and go and train elsewhere. So he was supportive right from the beginning, right from the moment I told him I was pregnant to that very moment where he didn't make me decide. So it never came back to, oh, Tanya made us move from that club. It was, he wasn't happy as well with the way I was treated. And that says a lot for me that a coach would turn around and go, no, I fully support my players, and if she's feeling uncomfortable in the situation, it's time for us to move. And he did that. And I'm really thankful for John O'Sullivan at the time. And my SNC at the time was Sammy Darling, who got me back out on the pitch, fully supported. John was fantastic. Like, he allowed me to bring in a babysitter, which ended up being one of the girls' sisters, and they were really close with. So it made life easy. He made life easy for me. Serge was in camp with me, training with me, travelling to France in the hotel with the girls, and got so much support back then from John. And Psycho was our manager, Rachel was our manager. They were all really supportive, and Serge just followed us around. And yeah, it was really, I was lucky back then.
Serge became the mascot for the team, I dare say.
Yeah, he's the mascot for every team I coach. I mean, you know, he's involved. He was involved throughout my whole Leinster campaign. You know, he was up there even this year. He wouldn't miss a game, although he was in France for one of them this year, but he was up there for the finals and sitting out the changing rooms. He's been to probably nearly every single one of my matches.
Right.
So I'm quite lucky. I don't know whether I'm lucky or he's lucky that he's been exposed to women's sport, because he's got such an appreciation for female sports. And if you had asked him after the 2014 World Cup who his favourite rugby player was, he would say Ashley Baxter.
Right.
Not Richie McCaw or anyone like that. It was, who's your favourite rugby player? Ashley Baxter, you know? So, yeah, I think he's pretty lucky to be around women's sport.
I definitely think he's the lucky one here, to be fair. So why then is hockey his love, his first love?
Oh, no, hockey's not his first love.
Okay, rugby is.
Rugby
absolutely.
And touch rugby is his first love. Touch rugby, his thing. He played hockey in school up until this year, okay. And he's decided to focus on the rugby.
Okay, so
my first love to watch is hockey.
Fair enough. Yeah. Good to have that clarified. In terms then of actually being a player for Ireland in that moment and what that meant to you in terms of your identity, can you describe that? Because I'm sure there's a couple of complicated factors here. Somebody who's come from New Zealand to represent Ireland, but then also the fact that the team doesn't get a fair crack at a whip in terms of the resources, in terms of its attention. Like there's a photograph behind you there of O'Driscoll and O'Gara. That will be around 2007, 2008, 2009 potentially. This is around that very era that we're talking about, where these guys are packing out stadiums. Men's rugby is exploding. People from non-traditional rugby backgrounds are really getting behind this team. And your lived experience is on a team that is still basically trying to be recognised.
Yeah, I mean, like, God, when I first started with the Irish women's team, we were bunking in each other's houses. We were sleeping on the floor. Fiona Coughlin was driving here, there and everywhere for her training. But we managed well with the resources we had. If there's one thing that our squad was good at, was pulling things together and working really, really hard. So one year before a World Cup, I had three of the girls live in my apartment so that we could get up every morning during the summer and train together, do extra passing together. And that was a commitment the girls gave. And then before the 2014 World Cup, you know, we were going to train at 5:30 in the morning to do the gym sessions, and then we're back training in the evening. But it was never questioned. It was never, oh, we're going to moan about this or anything. We just did it because we loved doing it. And that time we had some really, really good players. Yes, it was hard. I mean, I remember the 2006 World Cup I played in Canada. I was on the committee. There was five of us, and we had to brave. I can't remember if it was 40,000 or 50,000 to get to the World Cup. But the small committee, and I was one of them being a player, managed to raise that money, you know, to get across to Canada. And those were the times. But you just did it because you loved what you were doing. We didn't get any recognition probably until the girls won in 2013. And we went on and had a really good World Cup. I don't think we ever complained. You know, there was one year that Lynn Cantwell was our S&C. But we did it because we believed in each other and we worked hard for each other. And what people don't realise is, like, some of us would meet at my house, six or seven of us, before our club trainings, go and do our Irish trainings and then stay on and do club. Or if we didn't play, I remember getting, I think I might have got 10 minutes for one of the matches. I didn't even get on for Twickenham when the girls first played in Twickenham. And I remember going to Goose at the time going, can I go back and play club? And he was like, right, yeah, everyone's going back. If you didn't get so many minutes, you're going back to play club rugby. But you can't do that now. So we were still getting some rugby in us if we didn't get on the team, which I thought was really, really important. And for me, I loved going back to play club rugby. I was playing Black Rock and I love club. And I just wanted to play rugby because I knew for me to get better or for me to get onto the pitch is I had to play a lot of rugby. And I think it was like as I had Wayne Smith coach me for sevens in New Zealand when I was about 15 or 16. And he said to me, the most important thing is you need to be playing sevens every weekend. And I said, but we don't play in every competition. And he's like, I don't care. Go and play for another team. For you to learn how to play rugby or sevens, you need to play every single weekend. And so that was my train of thought here when I came here and I started playing rugby is, if I wasn't getting on the international team for more than 20 minutes that I wanted to, I had to go back and play club. And I suppose that's where I learnt my trade is in club land with Black Rock. It was no resources, but we did all right. And then 2008 was a huge shift. The Europeans, I don't know what happened there. Simon Broughton came on board, he coached. Fiona Coughlin became captain. We did really well at the Europeans, and there was just this shift in women's rugby for us. And then we started to get better and grow and grow and things like that. So, yeah, it's been a journey.
Yeah, like you did touch on 2014 there. So you come back at the start of 2014, right?
Yeah.
How did it feel watching what happened in 2013 and seeing their unbelievable level of success, knowing that there was still rugby in you?
Yeah, like I was never planning on coming back.
Okay.
Okay, I retired. I had an injury in 2010. It had a bit of a tough time. My mum was sick back then. I went back to New Zealand. There was just a few things going on. I wasn't enjoying it as much. And for me, I need to enjoy something to do it, give it 110%. And at the time, I didn't. And then I decided, oh, I'll just play club rugby for me. So get fit for myself and things like that. Have a bit of fun throwing the ball around. And it just turned out that I became super fit, got back on top of my game. In 2013, I had a really good club season, inter-pro season. Then you see the girls be really successful and great. I still, even after that campaign, I still didn't have my eye on to go back into the national team.
Right.
But I did say to myself, I want to be the best player in club land. So even though they were all, Fee and all them were playing international, in my head, I was like, no, Tanya, you want to be the best player on the pitch in AIL. And I had a good season that year. And then Greg McWilliams approached me, asked me for a meeting. I didn't know what it was about. And then once we sat down, it was, would I go back in? And there was a few things we had to iron out before returning into the squad, because obviously things had changed from when I was in there, 2011, I think, 2010. And I had to meet a couple of other management and coaches to see whether I would fit in. So I didn't know whether I would fit back into that environment. And it turned out, yeah, really good. It was a great 2014 campaign. Was really enjoyable. I loved it. It was challenging. We beat the Black Ferns. Makuse was good. We just fell short on the next game. I think we probably played our final against the Black Ferns when we knocked them out.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It was an unbelievably successful couple of years. What was your expectation for where Irish women's rugby was then going to go in the next 5 to 10 years, let's say, up until, look, the last year or two has been so encouraging from that standpoint. Obviously, what precipitated that was real disappointment in terms of not qualifying for that World Cup and Ireland really reaching a low ebb. That low ebb must have felt like something that could never possibly have happened after 2014.
Yeah, I thought we're going to go on and push on and continue to be in that top four in the world and continue in the Six Nations competing with the likes of France and England. And then obviously those couple of years came about. And look, I just think people got their decision making wrong, the way things turned out. And it was just like, to be honest, it was really seeing us do so well at 2014. I stayed on in 2015 because Lynn and Fee and all our older players had left, and I was like, oh, I'm really worried about the young crew coming through. In hindsight, I probably should have retired after 2014 because 2015 wasn't very enjoyable. So, women's rugby went down and down from there, and it should have been the reverse. We should have seen, geez, what's working really, really well here? Who do we keep within this environment to make sure we excel on? But I think they ended up getting rid of the whole coaching team, pretty much the management team. So, you know, where was the continuation from a really good 2 or 3 years to continue on for the next 2 years? Even if they had kept one or two of the coaches in or the management team in, I think we might have got a better result heading into the next few years. But I think dismissing pretty much the whole backroom staff and the coaches probably wasn't the best thing to do. And then, you know, we lose the likes of, like, our team was full of rugby brains. Like, you know, Fee Coughlin loves standing out on the wing, and she always says she's opening doors, but, you know, she's a clever player. Lynn Cantwell was clever. Grace Davitt, unbelievably tough. You know, she'd run through brick walls. Nora Stapleton, clever. We had really clever players out on that pitch. They just had the knowledge of rugby. Now, we had been through that hardship of getting beaten all the time, but we had learned how to stick together and play rugby. Jill Burke, the hooker, another clever rugby player. Now she's down coaching internship with Aussie. To lose all those players heading into 2015, 2016 is quite tough on a squad.
you look at what that team is doing with their lives now, and it just completely backs up your point there in terms of the rugby brains that are on the pitch, whether the bits of punditry that they do, they all speak so brilliantly about the game, or the success that they've had in terms of their post-playing career still in the game. I don't think it'll ever be matched in men's or women's rugby, that collection of players going on to do great things afterwards. That being said, I'm always keen not to just say, oh, it was a great collection of players, and when they retired, of course there was going to be a lull. It felt that, sure, it was a freakishly gifted group, but more could have been done to ensure that the next generation were given every chance to succeed. And unfortunately, those days you'll never get back, as you well know. Those people who were in their early 20s in the 2013-2014 era never had the chance to actually give the best version of themselves in an Ireland jersey in their peak years. Now, thankfully, the wheel has turned again now, but that's too late for some people who've already been and gone.
Yeah, and they missed out on that good opportunity of, you know, developing as players. Like I look back on like 2016, 2017 and some of those younger girls coming through who potentially could have been fantastic.
Yeah.
And not, I mean, they've been good or whatever, but when I say fantastic, like you look at someone like Lynn Cantwell was a fantastic rugby player. A lot of those players in that era could have grown into that. And I think maybe we weren't, our pathway probably wasn't ready for it, or we transitioned too quickly to move on from where we were. We also got to remember we had Marion Earls as our S&C back in 2014, 2013. So a lot of those players stayed on and didn't get injured or pick up niggly injuries because we had good S&C timings.
Right.
So we got, you know, they got through a lot of the campaigns injury-free and lots of, I mean, I was the oldest player and I got through a World Cup without a niggle. You know, and that doesn't come down to me. That came down to Marion, who got me through S&C and all that kind of stuff. But I'm looking at, I don't know, someone like Ashley Baxter in 2014. Oh, she's a fantastic player. Then she went and played seven, so we lost her out of the 15 cycle. She's a player that I go, wow, I think she would have been like world-class winger or world-class 15. I used to love when I got back into the 2014 World Cup, and there's this young kid, Ashley Baxter, who could jump, I don't know, the height of me and could catch balls, unbelievable balls and speed. And all I could think was, oh my God, what's she going to be like in 3 or 4 years' time? And then she went to sevens and I was like, oh, damn it, she's gone to sevens, you know? It's just like some of those top players got sent across to sevens, and I love sevens. Sevens is my first sport. And if you said to me, where would you want to be this weekend? I'd say Dubai. So there's plenty of those players that have missed out on that in that 2016-17 era, which is a little bit sad. But now, I mean, look at the girls where they are now and who's coming through. I think the pathways have worked out well, especially in Leinster, the Leinster pathway. I think what they're doing in Leinster is really good. I did not so much know about the other provinces as well as I know about my own province. So
I think there's a case to be made, and it's probably fact after the Team of the Year was released this year that you've been working at Leinster with at least one or two world-class players, which really is the best rubber stamping of where that system is at the moment. From your own perspective then, that is the end point of your coaching career to date. There's going to be more to come, no doubt. Yeah. The Leinster head coach gig, which you had to finish up this year. What was it about coaching that appealed to you? And were you ever dissuaded from it by the fact that you always existed in environments where the man was the coach?
I suppose we're lucky in New Zealand. So if you play senior cup sport in New Zealand, you have to give back to one of the younger teams in the school.
Right.
So I was senior cup for netball and basketball and touch rugby. So I was always coaching the junior netball team, the basketball team, all in the touch team. So I think my coaching started really young when I was about 16. And then PE was a curriculum subject. And part of that curriculum subject is you had to take a 10-week coaching block. So I started coaching really young. And then I started playing touch rugby, which my dad coached. And then my dad decided he didn't want to coach anymore. So I was like, oh, I'll have to carry on that. So I started quite young in the coaching. I just felt that, I don't know what it is about coaching. I suppose because I'm a teacher. And being a teacher is similar to coaching anyway. I love the challenge of bringing people together. I love the challenge. I love seeing people develop and go on and become better. I love putting game plans together to try and beat other teams or, you know, analyse other teams to see how you can beat them and things like that. But yeah, coaching started really young for me back home. I suppose my inspiration probably comes from my basketball coach, Uncle Elliot, in school, who was a fantastic coach. So he taught us all about visualisation. So he'd go, okay, right, we're up, free throws now. And he'll put all the balls away. And we're like going. And so he'd just make us do all visualisation, stand there, visualise it.
Right.
So he introduced me to that. God, how old am I now? Years ago, anyway. So, like, I got my inspiration from him, I suppose, because he used to, back then we used to think it was wacky, you know, lie down on the floor, ground yourself, and all this weird stuff, and now it's just coming out, you know, everyone's doing it now, and visualization and mental skills stuff. And so all my inspiration probably for coaching came from him. And then, obviously, Simon's involved in coaching. And then for rugby here, I suppose, we struggled in Rock to find a coach to coach the women's team. And usually, like in club land sometimes back then, it'll be just any old man or person would come in and coach. So Rock, the girls, just one year just said, look, you know what you're doing. Why don't you just do player coach? So I kind of fell into it that way from the rugby side of things and have gone from there, really.
Your coaching obviously isn't just of women's teams. You've obviously been working with boys as well, and you were just telling me before we started this piece that you're working individually with a lot of players in terms of them trying to get to the next level in terms of schools rugby. At what point in the future do you think we'll get to a point where we will have a female presence in terms of the main coaching roles in rugby in this part of the world?
In
men's rugby, obviously.
Men's rugby. Men's rugby or women's rugby?
In men's rugby.
Men's rugby. I think we're a bit far from that, to be honest.
Because even in women's rugby,
the men are the head coach.
So that's probably the first barrier to break down.
So I think is there one or two of us? There's Fee Hayes and myself in the AIL league, female coaches. I think we're well off. I mean, when I coached in Clontarf, and I'd take the head coach, I was head coach of the Jays as well as working with their senior team. You know, it was like, oh, are you the physio? And that was only a few years ago. That was just before COVID, was that? Well, a few years ago, 6 years ago now. And those are sort of the messages you were getting.
Right.
Or you'd have, I'd be playing one club and you'd have, oh, what do you know about rugby? Go back to women's sport. You know, and in fairness to the Clontarf players, my Clontarf players were so good. And I remember a coach yelling that at me, and the captain walked off the pitch and said to him, don't ever speak to our coach like that. She's a coach, and she's a damn good coach. So the Clontarf boys were really, really good. But I don't think we're anywhere near close to getting a female coach in a head role of a men's team here.
And then the previous part of getting, so in terms of Six Nations, it's six male head coaches for now.
Women.
It feels that a sport like football has made much more of a breakthrough in that regard, even just within the confines of women's sport. Again, getting on to men is just a whole other mountain.
Yeah.
But why is rugby even lagging behind football with regards to women's coaches in women's teams?
I don't know whether people are willing to give us take a punt on the female coaches. I mean, you look at the English team, there's very good female coaches over there, and the likes of Giselle and them aren't getting an opportunity. You look at the Black Ferns, there's the likes of Anna Richards, now Whitney Hansen, she was assistant coach, but they still aren't getting an opportunity to coach down there. I think it's very still, how do I say this, male dominated. There's very few opportunities for female coaches to get coaching on the pathways.
Is it because the decisions are ultimately being made at boardroom level, and boardroom level is male dominated, and it's top down?
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I went into my Leinster review, and like I love Leinster. The club has been super fantastic and supported me so well. And Shane Nolan is fantastic. And the review were all males. And
right.
I was the only female in the room.
Right.
You know, so when you're looking at that, you're like, oh, God, where do we sit with this? Because, and nothing against who was doing the review, but what I'm just saying, you just look at it and it's just all men over there. And dealing with women is very different with coaching men. And sometimes males don't understand that. Sometimes I don't understand it. Sometimes when I coach females too, I just think sometimes it is easier coaching men or boys. There's a whole different psyche to women, and there's lots of different things going on for females. They're also like, they're all about their families, and I'm all about my family. So that relationship on how you coach a player is more so looking at their family life and all that kind of stuff. And like that, if I looked at Lentz, I don't know who's in the boardroom that is female. Now the great thing is we've got Lynn Cantwell coming on in August. Now, if I think there's going to be a shift happen, I can predict it's when Lynn gets involved and she gets on board. You're going to see a massive shift in Irish women's rugby across the board. It's just a pity she had to leave Ireland before we recognised how good she would be, you know, how good she's going to be. So that's exciting to see.
Absolutely. You've mentioned Fiona Hayes. We have her on the show all the time, and yourself and herself, obviously. I'm sure there's a beautiful rivalry that's developed there in recent times in the Leinster-Munster interprovincial games. But if we were to identify a female coach who might go on and break down those barriers from the perspective of Irish rugby, I guess yourself and Fiona are two of the people who've been in the most prominent roles possible so far. So from your perspective, what is next? What do you want to achieve in your coaching career next?
I don't know. I'm actually enjoying this little break. Like I said to you before the show, I was really disappointed 48 hours after my review about the policy, 3-year policy in Leinster. But then I was just like, wow, I've got a break coming up, which is nice. I don't know whether it's time to look abroad, but that's hard to say when Simon's here, Leinster Academy manager, and my son is 17, going into Leaving Cert next year. Maybe it's time to go back to the men's game. I do love working with the Balvo Club, so I will look to stay there. I've got no doubt I'll be there for another couple of years. But, you know, it might be time to start looking abroad and seeing what's across the ditch and have a crack there, I suppose.
Why is there a 3-year policy for the women's head coach at Leinster?
It's part of their domestic coaching policy across all their teams. So you'll see schoolboys under 18s, head coach has gone, Brent Igo, because he's finished his 3 years. Damien McCabe has finished his 3-year policy with the youth boys, 18 boys, and they're both, Damien won his campaign as well, and it's to do with their 3-year coach development policy. So
when you do your 3 years, you also need to keep developing yourself. So yeah. Where does that, because like if you now leave...
Good question.
If they see you as a talented young coach who's ready to go on to the next level, and you had to leave your post because of the 3-year policy, and you end up, as you say, jump in the ditch, going abroad.
Yeah.
Is that potentially seen as losing something from the system, a bit of a brain drain from the Irish rugby system, I wonder?
Possibly. Yeah, I can't answer that. I suppose it's my responsibility to continue my own development if it's not seen within the policy of Leinster. But what I will say about Leinster and Shane Nolan is they were fantastic support throughout the 3 years. Like Sean O'Brien came in and helped me out, offered to come in and help out. You know, Simon was there from the academy point of view. So the club was fantastic there. So I don't know, are they losing coaches? They potentially are. Like, if you've got a good coach in place, like, would you not find something else for them? But I totally understand their policy is to develop other coaches and things like that. I just probably now need to find my own pathway with probably RFU or along those lines with Darius Sheridan, whatever his name is. I can't pronounce his last name. I always get it wrong. but Dara and the RFU, that coach development pathway and things like that. So, it's a tricky one to...
Yeah, it is, because it feels kind of new as well. It feels that, like that after things have kind of got on the right track in the last few years, this interprovincial system is starting to show green shoots. The games have been really good. The rivalry is developing, and there's still a sense, even from a player standpoint, that the best players will still need to go to England in the current system. And maybe your situation is also indicative of a situation that the women's game just hasn't got up to speed at the men's, where everybody can actually progress forward in this country at the moment. So
I really hope. Like, you know, we were told that potentially that the provincial teams would be going pro, semi-pro.
Yeah.
I'd say that's another couple of years away. I do know that's what Shane Nolan from Leinster wants. And I'm going to throw this out on air, is, you know, when he first arrived in, he said to me that for Leinster to be the best club in the world, they have to have a great women's setup as well. And so he's put it out there, and I think he will do that for Leinster. I'm not sure about how the other provinces see things, but I do know that they have to wait for the other provinces. They can't just go ahead and do it themselves. It's right. probably more of the decision from the RFU than Leinster themselves, which is a little bit disappointing. I would like, if you're ready to go, if one province is ready to go, let them go. Why not?
Yeah.
And see if we can retain our players. I mean, you don't want to lose the likes of Aoife Wafer to a premiership team, or Erin King. You don't want to lose those players. Those, you know, they're Leinster players. And although Erin hasn't played senior Leinster, she's played underage. But you don't want the Irish girls to go across there. And for their own development, I totally get it. I totally understand.
That's the way it is right now.
That's the way it is. Look, after next World Cup, I've said this before on air, NRL in Australia, the women's NRL, I wouldn't be surprised if the likes of Erin King, Aoife Wafer, Brittany Hogan get approached from one of the clubs down there to go and play.
League.
Wouldn't that be exciting?
It will be very exciting for
but
the NRL.
For us. Yeah. But you know what I mean? They are, Aoife Wafer and Erin King are those types of players. They're really good players.
Yeah, I've absolutely no doubt of their potential.
Yeah.
It would be disastrous for
Irish
rugby. I know,
it would be, wouldn't it? So what are we going to do to keep them in Ireland?
I hadn't even considered that might be a prospect.
Well, there you go.
They're sniffing around.
They are sniffing around.
Wow.
Now, there are clubs already over here citing boys for the league down there, scouting players for the boys' teams. I would say, I can guarantee you, they're starting to notice some of these Northern Hemisphere players. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if some of them don't get asked after the next World Cup.
For NRL from the men's game as well. Wow.
It'll be more like the schoolboy level.
Yeah,
they'll be looking at our schoolboy level.
As opposed to Leinster players.
They won't be looking at Leinster, but...
Okay.
They'll be looking at that school level. Who can they take down, put in their academies to bring them through to play?
Right.
But I would, if I was the Broncos team, I'd come in, Aoife Wafer, come down. Now, it's hard. Now, what I will say is, do the Irish girls leave to go that far? I don't think so. It would be too far for them.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. But, I mean, in Aussie rules, we've seen it happen all the time now. There's never been a professional contract that was ever going to come to them in terms of Gaelic games or anything. So you can see why that's much more of a vulnerability in Irish sport. Mm. But hopefully the province is up their game here, and there's a world here where they can continue to play rugby union, succeed and get paid very, very well for it. Listen, Tanny, it's been a pleasure chatting to you. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Very best of luck with whatever is next. Like, I really hope the next gig is coming soon. I also really hope you get time to just enjoy yourself. Maybe if it's not your son's hockey team anymore, you do find some sort of joy in watching sport in some capacity. But a pleasure chatting, Tanya. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Settle in.
On Off the Ball.
It's brought to you by Guinness 0.0.